Hey everyone, Watto here, and you are about to hear a classic Curbsiders episode. If you already heard it, listen again for that space learning. If you haven't heard it, then you're in for a treat, and I'm kind of jealous of you. Now, if you want to hear a brand new episode of Curbsiders right now, then make sure you join us at patreon.com/curbsiders, where we've already released over 30 bonus episodes where Paul and I distill down high-yield topics in primary care. And they're shorter than our regular episodes, so some of you might enjoy that. Also, on those episodes, we answer listener questions about primary care topics. Plus, Paul gives some picks of the weeks. Check it out at patreon.com/curbsiders and enjoy this Curbsiders classic episode.
The Curbsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're wrong.
Paul, we are back. This is an action-packed episode on acute kidney injury with the great Dr. Joel Toff, or at Kidney Boy, as he is belovedly known. So, Paul, before we tell them a little bit more about Dr. Toff in this episode, can you tell them, what do we do on this show? Why do we do this, Paul? Why are we still doing this?
I think deeply entrenched masochism. I feel like I'm punishing myself for something I can't quite define. For me, I can't judge your motives, Matt. You'll have to tell us. But we are the Internal Medicine Podcast. We use expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And as you mentioned, we have the great Dr. Joel Toff with us. And I think, and you'll talk about it, this is maybe the first episode I spent with Dr. Toff where I did not leave filled quaking with terror. Like we left it a little bit on a hopeful note, I think. But you'll tell us more.
Paul, our fantastic guest, the great Dr. Joel Toff, he is known around Cashlack for many things and on Twitter as @kidney_boy, where he runs NephJC along with a bunch of his friends. He's part of the Freely Filtered podcast. He is one of the co-creators of Neph Madness, which we have, of course, featured on several Curbsider shows. He helps with the Nephrology Social Media Collective, which is an internship for those of you nephrology nerds out there interested in such things. And of course, his blog, Precious Bodily Fluids, where he is known as the Salt Whisperer, is also fantastic. He's won very prestigious awards from the ASN, including the Robert Narens Award for his innovations in teaching. So if you haven't met Dr. Toff, you are in for a real treat as we discuss AKI. And he's going to simplify this for you and make you feel hopeful, as Paul said, and tell you that 95% of the time, you will know what to do right away. And if you don't, then you just consult Kidney Boy. Joel, you're back for, it's got to be like the 50th time or something now. the audience keeps still, when we get praise for the show, they're always like, you guys have a great show. I especially love that Kidney Boy.
Yep. To a person.
I am honored to be here. It's really a lot of fun.
My kids even know who you are. They're like, are you still friends with that Batman sounding guy? And I'm like, yeah, he's on the show still.
So we're not to Uncle Joel point yet, but I feel like it's...
I would much prefer to look like Batman than to sound like Batman.
Aren't there some later comics where Batman's, kind of banged up and... Yeah, no offense, Joel.
Yeah. He's still a badass, though.
He is still a badass, yeah. I think that's the one where he takes out Superman, actually. But we're diverging from the topic. Joel, can you give the audience a one-liner about yourself? Tell them a hobby outside of medicine, and then we'll get on.
So I'm a 50-year-old white male who is increasingly recognizing the privilege that I was born into. I'm a nephrologist who enjoys adopting new technology to the job of medical education. I just celebrated 20 years of marriage to a great woman, and I'm a parent of twins who may or may not be attending college in the fall as the COVID epidemic rages across the land.
You know, Joel, last time we talked, I think the college thing was stressing you out to begin with, and I think that was just visiting schools and planning for a normal college admission process. I can't imagine it's gotten better.
My kids did great in the college lottery. And they got into excellent schools. And I just hope they get to go to those schools. It really, it would be a huge disappointment, given how much energy and, thought and time, and attention that they put into getting into these schools.
I think I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen when we put all these people inside buildings in close quarters and for extended periods of time. It sounds like exactly what you don't want to do during a pandemic, but people need to
learn. I look at those dorms and they look a lot like cruise ships.
All right. Before we get to the topic, Joel, did you want to give a pick of the week to the audience?
So I have two picks. So one is Zoe Keating. She's a cellist who also composes music. So I'm always looking for music that I can listen to while I work. And this has no lyrics. It's great stuff to listen to. So Zoe Keating is one. And then just last night, my wife and I finished watching this 9-part television series called Mrs. America. And it's a television series that dramatizes the women's movement and fight for and against the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s. It's just brilliant. I can't recommend it enough.
Where did you watch that? What is it on?
So it was on FX, but we just bought the series for whatever, $20.
Awesome. Paul, any quick recommendations?
You know, I can't recommend anything quickly, but there's a recommendation I made a prior episode. I just kind of threw it out. I just wanted to revisit because I didn't do it justice. So I'm going to recommend the game The Last of Us Part 2. And there's no way to talk about it without spoiling it, so I won't go into too much detail. It is basically about how the cycles of violence perpetuate themselves. It takes place in on planet Earth, where most of the population has been decimated by a terrible infection, and it's about various factions who feel strongly about things fighting each other, and the people who are sort of reckoning with past actions. And it is just one of the best acted, one of the most visually beautiful things that I've looked at, that has a tale full of sort of moral nuance that you just don't typically see with video games. And like, it's just, it's a masterpiece. And so I think the last time I said, yeah, I'm playing this thing and it's fine. So if you're into this kind of thing and you want to be depressed by a bleak landscape while still kind of admiring it at the same time, I would recommend The Last of Us Part 2.
Have you finished it?
I have.
Yeah, my son finished it. He was blown away.
Tell your son to call me. I need someone to talk about it with, but I don't want to ruin it for anyone. So we'll connect after this.
I need to start playing so I can be a better friend to you, Paul. I probably should start playing video games. My
or
kids would love
friends.
It.
I mean, either or.
Let's get to a case from CashLack. So Kyle Bean is excited to start intern year at CashLack Memorial on the inpatient nephrology service. And there's a number of exciting new consults this morning. All are requests to help with acute kidney injury, or AKI. And so bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, Kyle is excited to learn whatever he can about the diagnosis and management of AKI. And before bedside rounds, Dr. Suzanne Summers. Is this Susan Summers or Suzanne Summers, Cyrus? I want to make sure I'm doing this justice.
No, it's whatever you want it to be, Matt.
Okay.
It's whatever you want it to be.
I'm going
to
make it Suzanne.
I had a real hard, like, I'm drawing, like, the wheels are spinning. I'm trying to, like, how do I get to thigh master to kidney? Like, I could not make it work to save my life. But
Rhabdo.
Perfect. Thank you.
Before bedside rounds, Dr. Suzanne Summers, who popularized the thigh master, is the attending nephrologist. And ask Kyle, how is AKI defined and how might you approach a patient with AKI? He stammers and asks himself, how would Dr. Toff, his favorite med Twitter presence, answer this question? Fortunately, we have with us at Kidney Boy himself. So Dr. Toff, Joel, how would you answer this?
Right. So the definition of AKI has been something that's been, you know, it's kind of like the definition of pornography. It's hard to define, but you know it when you see it, right? And so, you know, essentially it's just a sudden drop in GFR. And this is not a great operational definition if you're doing a study. And so there's been a lot of movement in the last 20 years to really formalize the definition. And right now, we have as of 2012, the KDIGO, which is Kidney Disease International Guideline Organization, has come up with definitions where they've staged kidney injury from stage 1 through stage 3. They're based on changes in serum creatinine and changes in urine output. That said, we could go through those stages, but they're really not useful clinically. Those are useful if you're going to do a large study and you want to get a homogeneous group of people with certain degrees of renal failure. When we're talking about patients that we're seeing on the wards, we're just talking about there's a sudden decrease in kidney function, and that'll be evidenced as a rise in serum creatinine or a drop in urine output or both.
And usually the urine output thing, unless they have a Foley, you're probably not going to know how many ml per kg per minute they have. So if they're in the ICU, you might have that information. Usually it's going to happen when the nurse is paying attention to it. They're like, this patient hasn't urinated for like the whole shift. And then you're like, uh-oh, something's going on. So that I'm just adding my practical.
No, and I think that's absolutely true. And it's actually super important because, you know, the urine output really becomes into focus in the ICU when you'll get these conflicting signals. You know, you're in a patient who is getting massive fluid resuscitation because they're a trauma patient or they're a routine surgery patient. You take your pick, you know, but, and if they're anuric, they can be so positive, you know, 4 liters, 8 liters positive that it can dilute out the serum creatinine. And you'll see a patient completely anuric and the serum creatinine is not going up. And it's important to recognize no urine equals no GFR, and you can't be reassured by that stable creatinine. But yeah, more likely than not, if you're on the wards, if you're not in the ICU, the lack of urine output is a lack of documentation of urine output.
Joel, this is slightly going to get into the weeds, but in a similar idea, if someone is coming into the hospital in heart failure, do you get a similar dilution? Like if they're in cardiorenal syndrome, do you get a similar dilution of the creatinine? Do you buy that? And then you start to diurese them, it starts to go up, but stabilizes at a point.
You know, I think the cardiorenal patients, I think pretty reliably raise their creatinine. I'm not aware that they don't. The important thing to recognize in cardiorenal syndrome though, is that you shouldn't use the creatinine as the guide to your diuresis, that you need to look at the patient and you need to decongest them, even if it means their creatinine will go up to some degree. We know from follow-up studies that if you send somebody home who still has persistent volume, but their creatinine is stable, they don't do as well as patients that you get them completely decongested and accept some rise in serum creatinine.
Okay.
You gotta prioritize euvolemia over normal creatinine.
Okay. So my question, I don't want to confuse the audience. So the thing that Joel was talking about in the ICU where the patient's getting tons of fluid, not making any urine, that's where the creatinine gets diluted. Cardiorenal syndrome, not quite the same thing.
Not in my experience, no.
All right.
But this seems like a great place to transition into just sort of broadly, sort of how do you actually categorize or sort of frame causes of acute kidney injury? Do you have sort of a schema that you work from?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't, you know, this is the same thing you were taught in medical school. You were taught it, and it's the one example where they got it right. That the pre-renal, post-renal, and intrarenal is a great way to think about things, right? So the pre-renal are patients where there's just not enough perfusion or blood flow to the kidney. Most of the time, that's going to be due to volume deficiency, either nausea, vomiting, decreased PO intake, bleeding, shock of any cause, or heart failure, where the patient is volume overloaded, but they don't get good perfusion to the kidneys, or they have a lot of venous congestion preventing good flow through the kidneys. We call those all pre-renal azotemia. And then we have the post-renal causes. These are obstruction. So this is going to be prostatism in men, cervical cancer in women, kidney stone in the ureter if they got a single kidney, take your pick of other causes of
retroperitoneal fibrosis, which we famously missed on a quiz show way back when, Paul. A mystery case, remember, with Reza.
No, I blacked out during much of that.
Boy, that's kind of a dirty trick.
Yes.
Our episode today is sponsored by Panacea Financial, a nationwide digital bank built for doctors by doctors. Founded by two MedSpeeds doctors, Panacea Financial is designed to help you whether you're a medical student, a resident, fellow, or an attending. Panacea Financial can help with anything from personal loans to high-yield savings accounts, and can even help you navigate practice ownership opportunities. Rather than taking on high-interest credit card debt, Panacea Financial's PRN personal loan gives you a better way to cover expenses like relocation, board exams, or debt consolidation.
Did you know their PRN loans have interest rates less than half the average credit card rate, no cosigner requirement, and no prepayment penalties? Well, now you do. Also, Panacea's practice financing team supports physicians by helping you start, acquire, expand, or even buy into a practice or a surgery center. If you're ready to join the thousands of doctors who've declared independence from traditional banks, visit PanaceaFinancial.com today. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC. This episode is brought to you by Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that listens, transcribes, and writes medical documentation for you. Gabby, a family medicine physician, and Iris, a computer engineer, came up with Freed, a solution that could help alleviate the daily burden of overworked clinicians everywhere. And for Iris, selfishly, it would mean they could spend more time with Gabby, who is spending nights, weekends, and holidays updating medical documentation. Freed turns clinicians' daily workflow into accurate documentation instantly. There is no training time, no onboarding, and no extra mental burden. All of the magic happens in just a few clicks, so clinicians can spend less energy on charting and more time on doing what they do best. Today, more than 4,000 clinicians and their spouses have fallen in love with Freed. Freed is an AI scribe that does your medical documentation for you. Charting is critical and necessary, but it steals your focus away from your patients, eats away at your time with your family, and keeps you up at night. The burden of always having another chart to complete drains every clinician. Freed is an AI scribe that makes charting go away. It does your soap notes for you. Freed listens, prepares your notes, and writes patient instructions. Charting is done before your patient walks out of the room. Freed learns your style over time, just like a human scribe, and it will never quit on you. Freed is loved by over 4,000 clinicians from every specialty. It is HIPAA compliant, it takes 30 seconds to learn, and costs only $99 per month. And you can try Freed for free right now by going to freed.ai. And listeners of the Curbsiders can use code CURB50 for $50 off their first month.
Right, and the tough one about retroperitoneal fibrosis is it usually doesn't present with hydro, that the fibrosis is usually so tight that you can ultrasound them and you won't pick it up.
That's just infuriating.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. That's not fair. Come on. So, and the great thing by, you know, and then between those two extremes, between prerenal and postrenal, you've got the intrarenal causes. Primarily, that's going to be acute tubular necrosis, but it can be, you know, drug reactions, vancomycin or aminoglycoside toxicity. It could be the glomerulonephritis. It could be the vasculitises, the ANCA-vasculitis. A lot of the complex stuff that really attacks the kidney is going to be in the middle. And why I love this schema is if you kind of take a look at patients that present to the hospital with acute kidney injury. So their presenting complaint is AKI. Somewhere between 70 and 90% of them are going to be either pre or postrenal. So that means a bag of LR and a Foley catheter fixes 70 to 90% of these people with acute kidney injury. And you're the hero, right? You don't need a nephrology consult. You get this done. You get the nephrology consult just to gloat, right? Just to say, hey, I got
look
this.
What I did.
Tough. I don't need you. I got this thing taken care of. Creatinine's coming down. And then that just leaves the middle part, you know, and somewhere, and depending on, you know, which study you're looking at, it's going to be somewhere between 10 and 30% of them will be intrarenal. But again, the vast majority of those will be what we call acute tubular necrosis, which is a sudden drop in the blood flow to the kidney. It causes ischemia to the tubules and the kidney shuts down for 2 days, 4 days, 6 weeks. Take your pick. Some range of time. Most of them are going to be somewhere between 4 days and a week. And there's no therapy for that. Make sure they don't get further hypotension. Don't let them get further harmed. Avoid additional nephrotoxins, right? Don't give them an aminoglycoside. We try to stop the ACE inhibitors. We don't have good data that helps, but it's what we all do. Avoid contrast is something that we always recommend people do. Certainly avoid hypotension, avoid significant hypertension, and they'll get better on their own. So between LR, Foley catheter, and the tincture of time, you really have something around 90% of these things taken care of, maybe even more, maybe it's 95%. And you're really just left with just a sliver of diagnoses that are left where you actually need to be active and really drill down, figure out what's going on to fix these patients.
Joel, you tweeted this out, but just to plug, we already mentioned our friend Reza, the CP Solvers, who have their own podcast. They make these great schemas. And they have one for intrarenal AKI that's a very nice visual representation of this. So we can we can.
Well, and it's not a, it's not only the visual representation. I think they have a chief resident who walks through the whole schema, and he just does a brilliant job of going through it. It really is a top notch description of kidney injury. But the important thing to recognize is it's about 20 diagnoses, and they represent 1% of the full spectrum of AKI. The vast majority of them are real easy.
Yes. So interns, be reassured. You Foley catheter, some fluids, and probably it's if that doesn't work, it's probably ATN, and it'll probably get better as long as you don't do anything too stupid, make any sudden movements. Joel, I wanted to ask the diagnosis. So we've talked about how to categorize it, a bit of the differential diagnosis here. I wanted to ask about the lab values. You mentioned the creatinine earlier, and is that still the best way? Are there new serum marker biomarkers that you think will ever be prime time? I know I've been hearing about them for years now.
Yeah. Better biomarkers for kidney function are perpetually 5 years away. And
okay. And all right. That's what I thought 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what I thought 20 years ago. And we're just, it just hasn't happened yet. And they're starting to emerge, but I think right now urine output and creatinine do the job pretty well. And until somebody shows that we can really do a better job with something else, I think this is what we're going to be using.
Okay. I can deal with that. So Joel, when you first notice that somebody has an acute kidney injury, either because of low urine output or an elevated serum creatinine, what else are you paying attention to with the labs? Can you walk us through that?
Right. So the important thing is when you make that diagnosis of acute kidney injury, recognize that that's just the beginning. You haven't really fully characterized what's going on. In order to characterize it, the very next step you want to categorize it into, are they oliguric, anuric, or non-oliguric? So you want to take a look at that 24-hour urine output, because this is going to have huge prognostic indications on what we're going to be doing next. And so if they're anuric, that is going to accelerate everything. People get into a lot of trouble if they're not making any urine. And if they're non-oliguric, that's going to relax you a little bit. You're going to get a little bit more time and it's a little bit more comfortable. So you want to categorize it as oliguric or non-oliguric acute kidney injury. And then you want to say what it's due to, right? You want to take a look at, go through the patient's chart, talk to the patient, look at all the labs. Is this a patient who had a prolonged hypotension? Is this a patient who has severe heart failure? And this might be a cardiorenal syndrome. Is this a patient who's received vancomycin or was taking NSAIDs? And try to establish what the etiology is. And then you want to go through and you want to make sure there's no life-threatening electrolyte abnormalities that are secondary to the acute kidney injury. Make sure that potassium's okay. Make sure their acid-base status is reasonable. These are kind of the first steps. These are what you...
Uh-oh.
Oh, a curbsider's classic. You love to hear it, folks. Clocky's back, everybody.
The clock is back. It's going to be nine of them. I'm really sorry. I thought I turned the thing off. So after you've established that they have acute kidney injury, what the etiology is, what their urine output status is, you want to take a look at the electrolytes. You want to look for immediate life-threatening injury, potential diseases like hyperkalemia, like profound acidosis, like significant hypocalcemia. All those are part of the acute kidney injury syndrome. So you want to address those, because those are going to be things that your attending is going to want to know about and going to need to address on rounds.
So let's go to a case and let's talk about probably just a prototypic Paul Williams patient, the type of person I see all the time on the wards. Kyle and Dr. Summers, they're running the list. They visit their first new patient. The first patient they see is a 23-year-old athlete. He is in the midst of a two-time-a-day, what is it, two-a-days? Cyrus, help me out here. That sounds like something where you exercise or something.
Yeah, 2 days. It's like you work out in the morning and then you work out in the afternoon. It's, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, and it sounds awful. So he's doing 2 days. And someone checked his renal function, and he came in with doubling of his serum creatinine. And the primary team was hoping for some help working up his acute kidney injury. And so for this 23-year-old athlete who is working out twice a day like some sort of crazy person with this elevation in creatinine, I guess, what are the etiologies we should consider, and where should we start? So let's help out Kyle.
Right. So, we can just kind of it's unlikely to be prostatism in the 23-year-old athlete, okay? So I think obstruction seems less likely, but this is a kind of a classic story of a patient who's working out a lot. You worry about rhabdomyolysis. You also worry about if it's the beginning of the season, they may be taking a lot of NSAIDs to deal with kind of just routine injuries of starting to work out. So you'd want to look for – so and then lastly, he's working out twice a day in the middle of the summer, very hot. And so you're going to think about prerenal azotemia. And so when you approach this patient, you're going to say, well, you know, could this be NSAIDs? And so the best test for this is to talk to the patient and ask them if they're taking any NSAIDs, right? And so did you do that, Paul?
Well, this isn't about me, Joel. This is about Kyle. Of course I did that. I mean, for my typical 23-year-olds who are working out twice a day, that's the question I ask first. And Kyle asked, and it turns out the patient is actually taking NSAIDs. Maybe even on a daily basis, he's a little bit sort of achy. So now what do we do with that information?
Right. And so, again, it's a question of degree. But the way that the NSAIDs work is they block prostaglandins, and prostaglandins are needed when you get a bit volume depleted. Your kidney becomes dependent on prostaglandins to maintain perfusion of the kidney. And so you block those, you get volume depleted, then you block the prostaglandins that are the lifesaver for the kidney at this point, and you can drop the renal blood flow and induce an acute tubular necrosis through the NSAIDs. But an important corollary is that they kind of have to be volume depleted to get there. Okay. And so, you know, the other disease that's on that differential that you'll want to know about is going to be the rhabdomyolysis. Could this be someone who's over-exercising and developing rhabdo? There was actually a couple of kids from, I think it was Iowa, a couple of years ago that ended up with dialysis-dependent AKI from rhabdo in the preseason football.
Joel, so, I was going to ask a prognosis for AKI. When patients are saying, oh, okay, so let's say their creatinine's 3 or something like that, what do you tell patients when they ask you? I'm sure it depends on the patient, but for someone like this young 23-year-old athlete, the chances of recovering from AKI versus somebody, you mentioned some of these players were on dialysis. For someone that has an AKI, a young healthy person needs a couple sessions of dialysis, what are the chances that person's going to be on lifelong?
If they did not have pre-existing kidney disease, so these patients had normal kidney function, no CKD beforehand, prognosis is excellent that they'll get off dialysis, recover kidney function nearly to baseline or to baseline, and they'll do well. If they have a significant kidney disease, if they have, for example, stage 4 CKD, then the story is much, much different. And they have a much worse prognosis for getting off of dialysis and staying off of dialysis. You oftentimes see a patient with stage 4, get off dialysis if they had dialysis dependent AKI, but more than likely within a year, they will be back on dialysis and not be able to get off. It seems to be a real accelerant in that regard. But patients with normal renal function, prognosis is excellent that they should recover their renal function.
Dare we talk about the volume status exam a little bit with this? I know that's probably something that new interns should be learning. Maybe older attendings should be relearning. What do you put your stock in when you're doing a volume status exam? I think you quoted us before a New England Journal study from the 1980s where they took a bunch of like experts and they weren't too good at it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a situation where you have a young, otherwise healthy patient, err on the side of giving too much fluid. Right? Because you're not going to get into heart failure. You're not going to get into too much trouble. You got a patient who's facing potential for needing dialysis on the other side. You'd hate to need dialysis because you didn't volume resuscitate them enough. And most of these patients will tolerate the fluid. So I would be pretty aggressive with giving the fluid, especially if we haven't kind of delved into this, but if this is rhabdo, you know, pretty much the recipe to treat rhabdo is to give a lot of fluid. You want to maintain as much renal blood flow and urine output as possible. And rhabdo is not, you know, you usually can make that diagnosis at the bedside. You take a look at the urine, the rhabdo characteristically very dark, almost brown colored urine. On the urinalysis, they'll have large blood when they just do the dip on the heme section. But when you look in the microscope, no red cells. Classic for both hemolysis and for rhabdomyolysis, because the dipstick just detects heme, so doesn't necessarily detect intact cells, and that's what the microscope is for. So if you get that divergence where it's blood on the dip and no blood on the microscopic exam, that should lead to rhabdo or hemolysis as the etiology. Both of them can cause acute kidney injury. And both of them, you want to give them a lot of fluid.
Do you have any...
It sounds like you're relying... Oh, sorry, go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to ask a formula. Do you have any specific formula for... When you say a lot of fluid, can you be a little specific? Is it like 4 liters? Is it, are you giving 250 mLs per hour, 30 mLs per kg per minute?
Young, healthy person, 200 cc's okay. an hour.
Got it.
LR.
Okay. Sorry, Paul.
No, I was just going to go back to your question. It sounds like, Joel, you're relying much more on the patient history and maybe some studies that we'll talk about than sort of chasing down axillary sweat. You're not sticking your fingers in the armpits, and you're not looking for longitudinal tongue
furrows. I never miss an opportunity to put my finger in somebody's armpit. I mean, that's just part of the joy of the job.
Of course. I'm a nephrologist. I have to do this. You understand, ma'am.
Well, let's talk about a case like this where you have a young person. They're clearly – they have risk for volume depletion, plus they've been taking NSAIDs. Is this someone – do you send urine lights on all comers? I know – People pull out their little pocket medicine book, or now they probably look on UpToDate or whatever they're using, and they just order all these labs and urine studies for all comers with AKI. But you told us earlier that 70-90% of the time you can just fix this with fluids. Do you think it's worth sending urine lights on all these folks?
Well, I think you want to take a look at what you're thinking about on their differential. Mm-hmm. Here, our differential is going to be is rhabdo on one side and prerenal azotemia on the other side. And the question is, does a fractional excretion of sodium differentiate between those two diagnoses? Mm-hmm. And the important thing about, or one of the things about rhabdo is it's one of the causes of intrarenal AKI that presents with a low fractional excretion of sodium. So this is going to, this is one where it's kind of confusing. It shouldn't, the intrarenal causes are supposed to have a high FeNA. This one doesn't. And so here, if this is our differential, which I'm comfortable with, fractional excretion of sodium makes no sense and it's just going to cloud the picture because it's going to be low with either of our two leading diagnoses.
So you'd look for the positive dip and then the microscopy.
And in terms of ruling out prerenal azotemia, response to fluids, right? You're going to give this guy a couple of liters, probably have 3 or 4 liters by the time he reaches the floor, get a repeat creatinine. Is it getting better or getting worse? Right? I mean, that's the great thing about... there's no doubt that it's faster to give a patient a liter of fluid than it is to order the urine lights, get the urine lights back, and run it through a calculator.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's just so much more practical to give the fluids. Do you look at things like if you are just getting a plain old urinalysis with microscopy, you look at this. Do you find the specific gravity to be helpful? Do you find Hyaline casts in the urine and how much of that do you think is helpful?
Right. So, when I approach a patient, I love to get as much information as possible. I'm not going to ignore urine lights that they've been drawn. I just don't think they'd be particularly helpful here. The urinalysis is almost always available by the time I see the patient, and I get as much information from that as possible. Like if there are Hyaline casts, that's a sign of acidic urine. It's a sign of concentrated urine. Can it be a normal finding? Absolutely. But when you see a bunch of Hyaline casts and somebody that you're already worried about them being somewhat dry, volume depleted, it just fits with the picture. Same thing with urine-specific gravity, right? If you had this picture and the urine-specific gravity was 10-10, you're like, boy, that doesn't make sense. We're really expecting that urine to be much more concentrated, 10-20, 10-30. That 10-10 makes me think, wow, maybe this patient has already been resuscitated. Maybe this patient actually wasn't volume depleted and really we're dealing with something more complex like an acute tubular necrosis.
So with a patient like this, let's say the creatinine is 1.8. Can you send this person home? You have them in the ER. You give them a couple liters of fluid. Is it too soon to check in like 4 to 6 hours and send them home if it's getting better?
Right. I think in this case, the characteristic, the safest diagnosis is going to be prerenal azotemia. Patient can tolerate fluids. And so you'd want to confirm that diagnosis before sending them home. And the best way to confirm that diagnosis is response to therapy. And so I'd give them a couple of liters, 3 or 4 liters, recheck the creatinine. If the creatinine's not getting better, I'm not sure you know exactly what your diagnosis is. And I think I think you shouldn't send them home until you know why a formerly healthy patient has now got a loss of roughly half their renal function.
Okay. And as long as they're having urine output, even though you're giving them all this fluid, do you worry about this dilution of the creatinine that you had mentioned before? Like if they have no urine output, I imagine you would. But if they're making a lot of urine, you can assume it's a real drop in the creatinine.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think this case, I'm not sure that there's more to this case. Paul, do you have any other questions? I think we can probably go on to the next one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if this is the case to give our patient rhabdo or not, but I did have a specific question about that. Like, let's say if we actually have a diagnosis of rhabdo based on sort of history and then the blood work that we find, the urine looks, you know, it looks characteristic. How do you know when you're done? I feel like that's something we come up against all the time. When is it safe to discharge? How do you know that you've actually gotten them to a place where they're okay to sort of transition to oral fluids? Like, what sort of actual, do you have anything that you're sort of using as a metric to measure how to sort of transition and when to get them out of the hospital?
So I've looked into this and I don't think the literature helps answer this question, right? Like this is, and I think it's a totally relevant and super important clinical question, but I pay a lot of attention to the natural history of rhabdo because I've had the same question. And what I've noticed is once their creatinine starts going down, it never turns around. And so my sense is I give them fluid. I watch the CPK. Once their creatinine has peaked and started coming down, I feel very comfortable about transitioning them to orals and getting them out of the hospital. Especially, and again, all the caveats, do you have a responsible person? Are they going to come back if they get sick? All those types of things. But I just don't see a secondary, the CPK is still elevated. It's been coming down. The creatinine's been coming down, but now all of a sudden they got AKI late. I've never seen that. If they get AKI, they have it right when they hit the door.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes when you get the person with, I've seen the patient with CK 200,000 and they don't have AKI, and I feel compelled to watch them until it at least cuts in half once or twice, you know, down to like, it goes to 50, then 20 or 100, then 50. And then I'm comfortable it's on its way down and they're taking in food and drink. And that usually takes 24 or 36 hours, but I don't know. Maybe you can send
them. But if at 200,000, I mean, to get it down to below 20,000, that may be a week.
Yeah.
Right? Like it really can take a while for if it's that high. And I've seen, right. And that is the most remarkable when you see these people that have six digit CPKs and that no AKI, you're like, I mean, it's kind of flabbergasting, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And then sometimes those people, I think because most of us that do hospital medicine aren't exactly sure what to do with that. And we don't usually consult nephrology for these folks because if they don't have a kidney injury, so we're just, We keep them until the whatever our arbitrary cutoff is where we're comfortable.
Whatever your line in the sand is. But I honestly think if they didn't develop AKI, they're not going to develop it late.
That's good to know.
I think the volume deficiency is a huge part of precipitating the actual syndrome of rhabdomyolysis with kidney failure, and that if they're well hydrated when they get that rhabdo, they do fine, remarkably so.
Paul, did you want to read the next case?
Sure. So let's move on to our next AKI patient. They are in the ICU. They've been admitted for septic shock. They are intubated and mechanically ventilated, so it's good to have both usually. current medications, I mean, there are exceptions, I guess. Current medications include vancomycin, piperacillin, tazobactam, and propofol with fentanyl PRN. They were on vasopressors, but they've been off for 48 hours now. Their serum creatinine 6 months prior to admission was 1, and their creatinine on admission was 1.1. But today, the reason you've been called to their bedside to evaluate them is their serum creatinine is now 2.7. So this patient, obviously markedly different than our football player who's been working out a lot. So how does this history change your differential?
Right. So, you know, once you're in the ICU, once you have a patient who has, we have a diagnosis of septic shock, you know, 9 times out of 10, this is ischemic ATN, that they've got, they have an ICU-associated acute tubular necrosis. By the time we get the consult, they usually, you know, all the protocols call for 30 cc's per kilo for volume resuscitation, fluid resuscitation in the first whatever hour or management of these patients with sepsis. It's pretty unusual that you're going to then come in and say, you know what, I think they need more volume. Usually that's been taken care of long before they've been on pressors. And this patient has now off pressors, so they have been fully hemodynamically resuscitated. And I think it's unlikely that they're volume depleted. And, you know, occasionally, I'll see somebody who needs a further resuscitation, but very unusual. That's usually not on the differential. And likewise, obstruction, really unusual. Almost all these patients have a Foley catheter. You know, is it possible? You know, you mentioned a retroperitoneal fibrosis. Yeah, those things exist. You could have a big bulky tumor in there. You could have, you know, there, it's possible that there could be obstruction, but it really is much less likely. And your pretest probability of the moment you step onto the ICU that you're dealing with ATN is very, very high.
This episode is brought to you by Locum Story. There is a shortage of doctors in America, and locum tenens physicians help alleviate that strain. Did you know that 72% of healthcare facilities are now seeking locum tenens physicians? That's almost double what it was a decade ago. There's a lot to learn about the industry, and that's where Locum Story comes in. They're your source for all things locum tenens. You can find interviews on the Locum Story podcast with experts sharing advice about everything from finances to physician burnout, as well as firsthand stories of providers who have worked temporary locum tenens assignments. They get into why they work locum tenens, the experiences they have, and the advice they want to give to others looking to try it. You have questions, they have answers, and you can find those answers by tuning into the Locum Story podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts.
That said, you know, since there's really, and there's no specific medication for ATN, I kind of feel like my job is to pick out that 1 in 100. Like the reason I'm here, since there's really no intervention for ATN, is to make sure we're not missing that anchovasculitis, right? Oh, they intubated the patient. They noticed some blood when they were doing the intubation. Oh, really? Have we considered a pulmonary renal syndrome? Let's take a look at the urine, right? Like I think that ends up being a lot of your role as a consulting nephrologist, right? To try to pick out that 1 in 100. Otherwise, 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, it's going to be ischemic ATN. And then, you know, the key here is let's not make the patient sicker, right? This patient's on vancomycin and piperacillin. And so this is a combination that is well documented to cause increased acute kidney injury. It's a weird story because piperacillin alone, not really nephrotoxic. It's only supposed to be nephrotoxic when it's combined with vancomycin. And vancomycin itself, its nephrotoxicity is kind of not all that it's been cracked up to be. And a lot of this is just kind of the natural, or not the natural history, but the history of vancomycin since its discovery, that when it was first produced, it was just difficult to purify. And there was a lot of contaminants in vancomycin. And as it's gotten more and more pure, the risk of AKI from this drug has gone down and down and down. But it's not gone to zero. And there definitely is increased risk of AKI with vancomycin. But compared to like other toxins like amphotericin or the aminoglycosides, it's not nearly as common or as toxic as those other drugs. But it's there. So this would be a situation where you'd want to monitor levels, make sure they're not too high. Talk to ID. Is there an alternative drug that we can use?
Does it seem, even if you keep someone in what we consider the therapeutic range, 10 to 20, the vanc trough, that they can still develop an AKI? Or does it seem to correlate with the people that you check a level, random level, it's like 45?
Okay, so both of those are true, right? So clearly, you know, clearly the higher the level, the more the toxicity. And some of that is chicken and the egg type of stuff, right? Because what's associated with increased levels? Well, decreased renal function. And so if you have somebody who's got evolving AKI where their creatinine is going from 1 to 2 to 3 and you're giving them standard doses of vancomycin and you're not paying close enough attention, all of a sudden that patient's going to get a toxic level. It's hard to blame the AKI on the vancomycin. That seems to be a result of the AKI rather than a cause of the AKI. And untying that knot actually is pretty difficult. That said, I'm pretty convinced if you kind of look at all the risk factors for vancomycin toxicity, it does seem to be associated with more, giving more vancomycin. We see more AKI with the longer duration of treatment, with the higher doses of treatment, with the higher trough levels. So yeah, we want to keep those trough levels down, but they're not out of the woods. We can have patients that have maintained good trough levels below 15 the whole time. And they can still develop acute kidney injury. Oftentimes you get a kind of an acute interstitial nephritis picture, and that's not so dose dependent, just idiopathic patients sometimes get a reaction to the drug.
And we think that's the main mechanism. That is vancomycin just a particularly higher risk factor for AIN, and that's the cause of the AKI with vanco, or we just don't know?
It's a lot of don't know, because the reality is, a lot of the patients that are given vancomycin, we're just not doing kidney biopsies on. And so we have to kind of make up what's the cause or what's the mechanism. And it's difficult to do. So in some cases, you know, when we do have biopsies, we do see some interstitial nephritis. We also see some vancomycin casts develop in the tubules, which is wild. That's the cause of the toxicity. And then we feel that there's another group where it's just kind of traditional nephrotoxicity where not a lot of pathologic findings besides some damage to the proximal tubule cells. So you can get all three flavors of AKI from vancomycin. It's a little bit difficult to assess what might be the relative frequency, but it's not all AIN.
We're talking about AIN, acute interstitial nephritis. I feel that all I've ever learned about that is that I know certain drugs can make it happen. I remember PPIs for some reason, NSAIDs, and that urine eosinophils and a rash, if those are there, then wow, maybe you got a slam dunk diagnosis, but those are almost never there. And then it's just this specter, and I'm just thinking, oh, I guess it could be AIN, and I just write that in my notes. But I think there's maybe even one time where we were pretty sure this person had AIN. But for a patient like this in the ICU, they've had contrast, they've had vancomycin, they've had hypotension, they've had sepsis. Like, it seems very hard to make this diagnosis. Tell us you're better at it. Tell us you have an easy way.
No, I think you've nailed the absolute issue is that you have so many other more usual suspects to point to for the cause of the acute kidney injury in an ICU patient with sepsis, with hypotension, with pressors, with contrast, with vancomycin. Like, yeah, you're probably not going to get to AIN in this patient. Where we get the diagnosis of AIN is the patient who has none of those usual suspects that you kind of go through your whole evaluation of the patient. You're like, you know what? I don't see anything that might be causing the acute kidney injury. Maybe we should consider AIN in that situation. Comment, first of all, on the urine eosinophils. They are more common in ATN than in AIN. And so they're considered a low yield test and really should not be ordered. Okay. That even, you know, it's not even a situation where they're very specific, but not sensitive, or very sensitive, not specific. They're neither. They're lousy. Okay. Not something that we should be doing. What you will
they will
find,
never be taken off board questions.
Though. Never.
They will.
That's right. Forever. We will be making bad internists through our board exams, right? That should be their motto. Worse internists through board exams. But what we do reliably find, you reliably find white cells and red cells in the urine when you have AIN. And then you nailed it. The important drugs are going to be the PPIs, the antibiotics, and the NSAIDs are all classic causes for this. And then the classic triad of renal failure, fever, and rash really comes from the beta-lactam literature. And, you know, if you're using beta-lactams, that's going to be the syndrome you're going to see more often. But outside of that specific drug, usually it'll be kind of isolated kidney failure with this pyuria and hematuria. And then the primary treatment there is just remove the offending agent. Take your best guess at which it is. Stop that drug. And if you're not sure, go get a biopsy. See if you have that disease. And then there's some data that steroids may speed the recovery from AIN. It's pretty thin. Usually if I've gone to the trouble of getting a biopsy, I'm doing that because I'm thinking about doing steroids.
So Matt, and I know we have maybe a different case to talk about this, but Matt sort of snuck in the patient's, you know, gotten CT scans with contrast, and then you repeated it back, and I got all kinds of excited, like, here we go. And then you guys just kept talking about sort of other stuff. So I guess, you know, so for this patient, I mean, this would not be unusual. Say someone comes in with sort of undifferentiated sepsis, part of their workup, they get the scan, they get their PAN scan with contrast. We know this patient's creatinine emission was not terrible. It was 1.1, though we know that that's not a perfect marker for renal function. And now we have this elevated creatinine. Should we blame the contrast? Can we blame the contrast? I feel like you probably have some thoughts on this.
Yes, I have some thoughts. So the ideal study to figure out if contrast is toxic is a randomized controlled trial. Patients get randomized to contrast or no contrast. And this has never been done. It was attempted, but it was difficult to enroll patients and they abandoned the idea. And so what we're left with are controlled trials, but not randomized trials. And they, you know, patients come into the ER and some of them get a contrasted CT scan and some of them don't. And then we take a look at the outcomes. And consistently, when we do those trials, we don't see any signal at all that contrast causes acute kidney injury. Over and over again, different groups doing it, different ways of controlling it, propensity matching, what have you, whatever they've done, they've not been able to generate, they've not been able to show that getting contrast causes AKI. And it doesn't look like we're able to get a randomized controlled trial. So we're talking about this is the most sophisticated statistics using retrospective analysis. We can't find any hint that there's something called contrast nephropathy. Now, again, those are all venous studies. You can't randomize people to cardiac caths with or without contrast. They're all going to, with arterial studies, they all get contrast. And there's a belief that arterial contrast is worse than venous contrast. But it just, it really bothers me. I think it should bother a lot of people that we can't find a signal. We can't find the signal of increased acute kidney injury following contrast in these large epidemiologic studies, kind of no matter how they're done, any way you slice it. And avoiding contrast in patients with decreased kidney function, like there's a cost there. It's like, it's a hard cost. It's hard to measure, but like, you know, not giving contrast means that you're flying blind. You don't have as good diagnostic determinations. And you look at these studies that look at the frequency that people are giving contrast based on serum creatinine, and everybody below a creatinine of 1.5 gets contrast for, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the studies. And as soon as that creatinine goes above 1.5, as soon as there's a little H next to it on the labs, contrast use falls off of the table. And I'm looking at these patients, there's probably no difference in the patient's need for contrast. We're just treating them less well for fear of this contrast nephropathy, and a contrast nephropathy that we can't find any evidence for in our best studies. And so it concerns me that we're treating these patients less well. And my sense is if there is a contrast nephropathy, it's not nearly as common as we think it is. And we should be doing the studies we need to make the right diagnoses. Right. Cause honestly, I've seen it over and over again. The thing that makes patients better faster than anything else is the correct diagnosis.
That's a great quote.
Gotten sooner rather than later. Right.
So, yeah. And the sooner you make it, the better they do.
Yes.
I think if the patient is like CKD 4 or 5 on the verge of dialysis and, you know, they're coming in hypotensive and you're like thinking, do I really need this contrast scan? That's probably different than the person who's stable creatinine 1.6 and you're worried they have a PE and you want to know, you know, do I start this person on anticoagulation? It just seems like my impression from what you're saying is that there's probably more patients where we should pull the trigger on the contrast study if we think they need it, than who we should really just totally avoid contrast because the risk is just too high. But that's my interpretation of this. Like if someone's on the, unless someone's on the verge of dialysis or they're already in the middle of like a severe AKI and you don't want to add anything to the mix. But
here's what I would say is patients with a severe AKI, whether they need dialysis or not, are in mortal danger. I mean, severe AKI in the ICU is a disease where lots of patients are not going to make it out of there alive. And if you think you might need contrast to save their life, by all means, give them the contrast, right? Like, when you've got that blade up that you're up against that, and we've all seen these patients, I think it's the wrong thing to do to avoid contrast in that situation. What I would turn that around is if that same patient, you know, had a gram positive cocci in the blood, would you give them vancomycin? I mean, they're close to dialysis. Give vancomycin without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right? You wouldn't even hesitate. And you're like, well, if they get into AKI, we'll deal with that later. We'll call Toph.
Yeah.
And he'll bail us out. And I think that's kind of what we should be doing for contrast. If you need the drug, if you need the diagnostic procedure, get the diagnostic procedure. And we'll deal with the AKI if it happens later. But we need to make correct diagnoses on these patients.
Since we're on the topic of, I know this does not cause acute kidney injury, but can you just speak to gadolinium? It seems like for a while they were not giving gadolinium studies to patients with CKD4 or below. And now, at least at Cashlack, it seems like people aren't so afraid of that anymore. And they seem to think maybe the newer agents or whatever we're using at CashLack is not really the risk for this nephrogenic systemic fibrosis that we all worried about.
Yeah. So we had a number of those cases at the hospital that I work at right now. And some of them were my patients, and it was, it's a horrible disease.
Right.
This NSF it's horrible. And all the patients died except for one that I knew. And it was really bad. I personally am pretty terrified of it. And there was a really important meta-analysis that came out, I think came out in December of this year. It was in JAMA Internal Medicine, and it was a massive study. I think it was 4,931 patients with CKD stage 4, 5 and dialysis that were given these newer agents, and not one of them developed NSF. 0 for 5,000.
Wow.
And I think that was very reassuring. I'm convinced that if they are not on dialysis and you're using these newer agents, you're going to be fine. I'm not entirely convinced in dialysis patients that it's completely safe. That's where I am. But I think you can point to, they did it 5,000 times and there wasn't one case. Pretty reassuring.
For the listeners, they can talk to their local nephrologist and their local radiologist and make a shared decision about whether or not it's safe for the patient.
And I want to emphasize that there are people that believe that there are additional consequences to gadolinium besides this NSF, this systemic fibrosis condition. That was not assessed with this. This was very specifically looking for this one complication, and so something to keep in mind.
So let's stick with our ICU patient because we haven't made them complicated enough. And as we're working them up, their creatinine is sort of steadily worsening, and the ICU team gets more and more alarmed, and the interns become a little bit more excited and start asking more and more about initiating urgent hemodialysis. So I guess, As this team's consulting nephrologist, when should they be thinking about initiating hemodialysis for this patient?
Right. So we've actually kind of stumbled into an area of active research in nephrology. And so there was a large contingent in nephrology that felt that getting these patients on dialysis sooner in the course of AKI would result in better outcomes. And there was a large multi-site study called AKIKI that tested this hypothesis. And it's one of a number of studies. And so far, the score is all of them have been negative except for one called ELAINE. But the vast majority of studies that have looked at early dialysis have not found a benefit in outcome when you do dialysis early. And what they also found is if you did dialysis early, and then since these patients were randomized, you could see the natural history of early versus late dialysis. And a lot of the people in the late dialysis never needed dialysis. So you had a much lower need, utilization of this resource in the late dialysis. And so since there was no improvement in outcome, that meant a lot of people in the early dialysis group were getting dialysis and would never need it. And that weighs on you pretty heavily. We know what patients go through, both just mentally having to, understand, and their families have to understand, oh my God, they're now on dialysis. And in half the cases, it was completely unnecessary. And so I'm firmly in the camp of I don't do early dialysis. I really need to be pushed by some symptom to do dialysis. And that sometimes is going to be hyperkalemia, but a lot of times in the ICU, it's going to be volume. Once you have trouble oxygenating, with patients really getting volume overloaded, that's a move where I'm going to push, hey, let's start dialysis in this situation. And so that's what I'm doing. We're going to see probably in the next few weeks additional data on this early start dialysis. So maybe I'll be singing a different tune pretty soon, but I don't think so. I think we're going to see consistency. The interesting thing is that it was a French study called the Kiki looking at early start dialysis. That study was negative. They are now running the opposite study. They're now randomizing patients to start dialysis as late as possible, right? They started early dialysis, didn't work. Let's go the other way. Let's see if starting as late as possible is advantageous. And I'm super interested for when that study comes back.
Can you define what was the difference in time between the late and the early group, or between the early group and then those who they tried to wait longer? Are we talking within 24 to 48 hours for the early group versus like 5 to 7 days for the late?
So the early group essentially was, as soon as they were randomized, they were initiated on dialysis. And I think they started, I think that was stage 3 AKI. So that's a tripling of the serum creatinine. So you think about that. I mean, they have a baseline creatinine of 1, creatinine of 3, they're starting dialysis. That was the early group. Paul's reaction is my reaction, right? It seemed a little crazy. The one study that was positive was the study called Elaine, and they started even earlier. I think they started those patients in stage 2. So the people that are committed to this really think that early dialysis really helps, though the data has not been very supportive of that.
Okay. So we have one more case, and we've all agreed that we could not, without making this show 3 hours long, cover glomerulonephritis and nephrotic syndrome. And I think that's going to have to be a future episode with the
it's
great.
It's called a podcast, not a fellowship.
Right. Right. So if the audience wants us to, we can commit to doing an episode on that in the future. But for now, let's say young Kyle, he's no longer doing consults in the ICU. He's now fielding some outpatient clinic calls, and he comes across a patient who's on Trimsulfa.
I was going to say, that's because Cashlac has an excellent nephrology teaching service where we don't just put them in the hospital. We bring them to the clinic where they can see patients in their clinic.
Yeah.
It's a comprehensive global view of nephrology. We've done an excellent job.
Doctors.
And they recognize outpatient medicine is God's work. It's all correct.
Yes.
Good for Kyle.
He comes across this patient. They're taking Trimsulfa for prophylaxis after an organ transplant, and he realizes that he thinks maybe Trimsulfa affects the serum creatinine, and he's wondering if that is the cause of this patient's, let's say this patient's creatinine normally is 1, now is 1.4. How whomped up do you get about that for a patient that's chronically on it?
And this is an acute change. We had a 50% or 40% increase in the serum creatinine.
Let's say the last value we had was 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were they on Trimsulfa at that first visit?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I'll tell you what, the Curious Clinicians group did an excellent podcast dedicated purely to Trimsulfa and its effect on serum creatinine. And it's a really worth a listen. But the key here is that Trimsulfa can reliably increase the serum creatinine by blocking tubular secretion. Essentially, serum creatinine is not only filtered at the glomerulus, but there's some degree of secretion in the proximal tubule, and that gets blocked by Trimsulfa. And when that happens, your serum creatinine will go up a little bit. So that's a reliable finding. Everybody's creatinine is going to bump a little bit when they start Trimsulfa. Additionally, it can cause classic AKI, and there's a couple of different mechanisms. One, it can cause interstitial nephritis, just like every antibiotic can cause interstitial nephritis. It can cause, it can crystallize in the tubules. This is usually something we only see in high doses in patients that have pre-existing chronic kidney disease, but it can crystallize in the tubules, cause an obstructive pattern, also cause AKI. The last important thing is it can act like a potassium sparing diuretic. It can block the epithelial sodium channel, so you can get some degree of hyperkalemia with the drug also. And so in this situation, I would want to get a UA, and I want to take a look and see if they have white cells and red cells in the urine. If I see that, that starts to alarm me that this could be interstitial nephritis or can be the crystallization pattern. Again, the crystallization, less of an issue in standard doses, especially prophylaxis doses, which tend to be, one single strength a day, or one double strength 3 times a week. They typically don't run into those types of problems. But a jump from 1 to 1.4 is worth a further workup and an evaluation, a repeat UA. Check the creatinine in a week, see if it changes, have the patient drink a bunch of water, have some soup.
And with Trimsulfa, would you stop it in this patient? And what sort of bump in creatinine is within lines of what's normal for this? Is it a 0.3? Is it a 1.5 times their baseline, not a 2 or a 3 times?
So you're talking about a 10 to 20% bump in the serum creatinine when you start the drug. So 1 to 1.1, 1 to 1.2 is what you're going to expect from the drop in tubular secretion of creatinine.
And is this a drug? We were talking a little bit in the pre-recording. Let's say this patient also on an ACE inhibitor. He's on Trimsulfa. The creatinine has gone from 1 to 1.4. We don't know if that's acute kidney injury or chronic. How are you handling these drugs? And anything else you would tell this person to stop, if anything?
So I think with just the amount of data that we have right here, I wouldn't get super excited about that. I'd check the UA, I'd get a repeat in a week, have the patient drink some more water, have some more soup, try to make sure their volume resuscitated. I think if you start, you know, stopping all these medications, stop your diuretic and stop your ACE inhibitor for these kind of, you know, mild changes in serum creatinine, you're going to get patients paranoid about their own medications. I want to make sure something is real before I start putting the brakes on all these pills. Now, if you have them come back a week later, now the creatinine's 2.2. Okay. Now stop your ACE inhibitor, stop your diuretics, make sure you're off your NSAIDs, and let's get a repeat UA, and let's get maybe consider an ultrasound at that point, and let's figure out what's going on.
So you mentioned the ultrasound. Paul, I think this is your opening here.
So I just wanted to confirm, I think, what we already know, but it's always nice to hear a question that you know the answer to confirmed out loud. So for patients who have acute kidney injury, they should absolutely all be getting renal ultrasounds probably as quickly as possible. Is that correct, Joel?
So Tony Brew, I think this was actually one of his targets for things we do for no reason. I'm pretty sure kidney ultrasound's there. You know, what are we looking for in the kidney ultrasound? Primarily, we're looking for obstruction and hydronephrosis. And can we get a good idea with that with a bladder scan? Maybe an in-and-out catheter. Absolutely. Usually we can take care of that. I personally like to get ultrasounds on patients with real AKI. I don't ever want to miss an obstruction, but I think that's rarely the diagnosis. And if you could probably get by, like I said, with a bladder scan, with an in-and-out catheter, work them up. See if you guys, if it responds to those things. If it doesn't, maybe as a kind of a second line therapy, you can go in, or second line diagnostic if things are still confusing, check a kidney ultrasound at that point. Though, quite honestly, after you've done those things, a low yield test will become even lower yield. Yeah, and I would describe the kidney ultrasound as a low yield diagnostic in the midst of AKI.
I think Joel, we had gone back and forth about this. I think it was Neph Madness maybe two years ago. And I like the tack that you take, that even if you're not going to get the full renal ultrasound, just make sure you don't miss the fact that the patient might be obstructed. So like you said, the in and out cath, the bladder scan, ask them questions in the history just to see what is your suspicion that this person might have an obstruction. And so it's not a totally worthless thought exercise to do. You should definitely think through it, but you don't have to like, what kills me is I'll be like rounding and like my patient's off the floor. I'm like, why is this person off the floor? And it's like, they're at their renal ultrasound. I'm like, their creatinine was 2 when they came in. It's 1 this morning. Why do we still need this test? You know what I mean?
Don't.
That's
right.
That's when I get a little bit bent out of shape about it. But I think we are.
Because I think the numbers, I'm looking at the episode notes now. The one study showed it cost $45,000 of renal ultrasonography to find one case of intervenable hydronephrosis.
But you're going to want to find that case, Paul.
Yeah, but you don't want to miss that case 100% because that will cost them way more for sure.
I think we've done some hero's work tonight trying to get through this. This was a massive script. Cyrus did a great job putting this together. We definitely left some topics on the table, the GN nephrotic syndrome to name a few, but That could be for a future episode. Joel, did you want to give the audience a couple take-home points before we let you go?
Okay, so one of the first things is that though when you were taking second year pathophysiology in medical school, you learned about these unique separate buckets of pre-renal, intrarenal, and post-renal. And once you get to the wards, it's not going to be that clean. You're going to have a lot of patients that are going to have some pre-renal azotemia, and they'll have some partially reversible AKI that their creatinine may go down from, you know, from a bit, you know, maybe a baseline of 1. They got volume depleted. The creatinine goes up to 3. You give them fluid. Creatinine comes down to 2, but it doesn't get all the way better. Why is that? Well, in addition to the pre-renal ischemia, there was a little bit of acute tubular necrosis, and these things will bleed into each other. You know, you can think of the patient who's got the kidney stone, and they're vomiting, and they're taking NSAIDs, and they got pre-renal, intrarenal, and post-renal all at the same time. Like, patients are messy, and you know, Hickam's dictum really does exist. Patients can have as many damn diseases as they want. And so you just can't be, you can't be Catholic about this. You just got to understand that things are going to, people have a smear of different diseases. You need to be careful with that. Urine electrolytes are probably overused in acute kidney injury, and that what you're really trying to look for is, are these patients have volume responsive acute kidney injury? And the best way to determine if it's volume responsive is to give them volume and look for a response. The more you learn about urinary lights, the less reliable they are, that there's a lot of conditions that should not have a low urine sodium, but do, and gonna be, make the situation a little bit more confusing than you'd like to think that it is. And that the last thing is, you know, this is something that you need to respect acute kidney injury, but recognize that most of these patients are going to get better with a bag or two of lactated ringers, which you want to use rather than normal saline. You want to make sure they're not obstructed, so either an INO cath or a Foley's catheter. And then if you think that it's intrarenal AKI, you still don't need to panic, because most of those patients are going to get better with time regardless of what you do. Don't let their blood pressure get too low. Don't get their let their blood pressure get too high. If they're getting a bunch of diuretics, maybe you want to back off on those. Make sure, go through the MAR. Remember, ketorolac is an NSAID, right? Make sure you're stopping all the NSAIDs. These patients will largely get better.
Thank you. And I think we'll just fade that into the outro. Actually, I guess we should ask you, Joel, do you have any plugs that you wanted to give before we let you go?
So I had a unique opportunity. I was invited to be the special editor of an issue of a journal called the Seminars in Nephrology. And they asked me to find 10 different articles on social media in nephrology. And this was just an absolute delight. And we have a lot of people from Med Twitter that have contributed to this. There's 10 different aspects of social media and medicine, from Twitter to podcasts to Twitter journal clubs to tweetorials. All of those are available at Seminars of Nephrology right now, and they are open access for about a month. So if you want to take a look at these, get them while they're good.
Okay. We will link to those in the show notes. And that'll be all. Thank you so much, Joel.
Delightful. Always a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Sure. Get your show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast and sign up for our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledge food to get our weekly show notes in your inbox.
And we're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. But to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com. A special thanks to our producer for this episode, Cyrus Askin, Dr. Cyrus Askin, and to our social media team, Beth Garbs Garbatelli on Twitter, Mad Dog Maddie Morgan on Instagram, and Chris the Chew Man Chew on Facebook. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And we should mention, the melodious music you're hearing in the background was composed by the great Stuart Brigham, so many thanks to him, as well as thanks to Claire Morgan of Notterly for editing our audio. And as always, I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams. Thank you and goodbye.
And thanks to our partner, VCU Health Continuing Education, who's helping us offer free CE credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals. Check out curbsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.